C1M. Number 10A.
So, we have seen that in this sixth subject, we get the savior from all these beliefs of mortality. First, in truth's mind, by recognizing something about this higher nature of man, namely that it is the divine mind and not this erring human concepts that are controlling our life. That it is recognizing that the divine mind is the governing and controlling factor of our being. That frees us naturally from all this sense of heredity. Then we come to spirit, and in spirit we begin to realize something more about the higher nature of man, namely that this higher nature of man does not come from parents, but from spirit as our true ancestor. That man evolves really from spirit and through spirit, that man really evolves through good qualities, the good and pure, and through the good and pure. She speaks here that in science, man is the offspring of spirit. See how very different this sixth subject is from the fifth. There it was the formation of mortals, and how mortals spring from mortals. Here it is man. We are freeing ourselves here from the sense that we are mortal, and seeing that the higher law is governing the lower. Therefore, that the higher law of man coming and being governed from mind rules and governs the belief that we come from mortals. Here in spirit, we see that the beautiful, good and pure constitute our ancestry. In the tone of life, we saw that our parents constitute our ancestry, and that it was dependent on how good or how bad they are, if we are good or bad. Here we free ourselves and see, no, the savior is that we understand our true ancestry, which she depicts here as the good and beautiful and pure, and that's our ancestry. And she goes on and says, therefore, his origin is not like that of mortals. See, she compares man with mortals. Mortals have their origin in brute instinct. And she says, nor does man, the real man, pass through material conditions prior to reaching intelligence. Spirit is his primitive and ultimate source of being. God is his father. No more the parents are our father and mother. God is his father. Life is the law of being. Not like in the fifth subject where it was that the law of our being was what our parents were giving us in the way of education. Now we free ourselves from that. Well, we must free ourselves from that, because most of us could not be satisfied to have only that what we have got in our childhood. So let's broaden out our view, widen it out, and go back to the Father as the source of our being. So we see the Savior here in truth of spirit by seeing that only the spiritual qualities are our ancestors, and that we can only evolve and have been only evolved through spirit and spiritual qualities. Well, these are words, but if one thinks them out and ponders them out and prays them out and atones them out, they become warm and saving and comforting and strengthening and liberating and freeing us in a measure that words cannot convey. But everything starts with presenting the letter. Then she goes to a third point of understanding man's higher nature, truth of soul, where she speaks about the rights of the two sexes. It's the point where we must wed ourselves to the higher and to the understanding of man's higher nature, of that nature which is not classified through sex, but is spiritually classified and therefore has not two sex and the distinction and the unequality, or is it?
Inequality.
All right. Inequality of men. Well, here she shows that civil law, for instance, or common usage, she speaks also of our laws, that they don't recognize the equality of the sexes, that these make distinctions between the rights of a man and the rights of a woman. Whereas she postulates and speaks then therefore of Christian science, furnishes no precedent for such injustice, and postulates the equality of the sexes. So in this way we get a wedding to a higher sense of manhood by seeing that we cannot make that cruel distinction by giving more rights to the male than to the females, to the men than to the women. That fundamentally both, as they are created by mind and evolved through spirit, they have the same nature and quality and therefore same rights. She touches here another very crucial point for me about the elective franchise for women, and I've come from Switzerland. And you know that in the paper they say that Switzerland is, besides some very primitive nations like Saudi Arabia and Yemen and Jordan, the only country who has no elective franchise for women. So what can I teach you? But you know, I have two hurdles to overcome in this chapter. First, I'm a bachelor, and second, I come from Switzerland, which doesn't give me the right. But every time when something like this bothers me, there is a guardian angel. And before I came here and went into the airplane, and they start with the engine, and at the right time the engine broke down and we were saved, so to say. We go back to the airport, had to wait for another plane. I took up a propaganda leaflet of the British Airway on Switzerland, and there was the guardian angel for my talk, because a British journalist has written in this leaflet the following: Switzerland is not an ordinary country. You will be convinced of this when you learn that it is the oldest democracy in the world, that the president of the confederation is not invested with supreme authority. That's why we never know the name of him. And that every Swiss soldier must keep his rifle and ammunition at home. So be careful when you come home to me. I have a rifle and good pure ammunition. But then he goes on and says, moreover, its government is the most stable in the world. Undoubtedly due to the fact that the Swiss women, like those of some primitive tribes, have not the right to vote. So I'm out of this one. Now, the point is that Mrs. Eddy isn't quite sure about that question either. She says, if the elective franchise for women will remedy the evil without encouraging difficulties of greater magnitude, then let us hope it will be granted. But she gives a practical rule and says, a feasible as well as rational means. And now she comes to the practical propositions. A feasible as well as a rational means for improvement at present is the elevation of society in general and the achievement of a nobler race for legislation, a race having higher aims and motives. So she shows that the savior is not in something outward, is not by the question, shall we give the same voting and electing rights to women as to men? It's not by changing the laws, but by changing really the inward attitude of every man and woman. It's soul that says we must first resurrect ourselves inwardly in the understanding of what is dignified for men and women, and therefore first have, or what is feasible and rational and practical at present, is the elevation of society in general and the achievement of a nobler race for legislation. I think if first we resurrect in thought and awake in thought to a nobler sense of the dignity of men and women, then naturally also we will give the respective laws and regulation to secure this higher sense and dignity of men and women. And I think in this respect we have to achieve a lot today, because it seems anyway in our country, quite apart from the elective franchise of women, quite apart from that, that the laws in many countries, and certainly in our country, is not fair to women. It's not fair. And so what we must see here first is that we go back to soul, to the equality of men and women, to that balance which we must see of male and female qualities, and not find that the one is worse than not so good as the other. Then we come to the next page, to truth as principle. Here, what is it that we have to recognize in order for the higher nature of man? What she hints here is that we have to recognize really that man is generic, that man is wedded to all men really, and not only to a single person. And therefore that man is related to the whole world, to every man and woman, and not only restricted to a bondage to one relationship, to a one to another one relationship. She points out here really that marriage, the human sense of marriage, can be can result in the inhumanity of man, because it tends to restrict relationship to just to one, to a relationship from one person to another, and therefore deprive us of the wideness that a relationship with all other people should give us and should be supported. That it could deprive us from visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction. That it could deprive us to lend a helping hand to some noble woman struggling alone with adversity. That jealousy and mistrust and egotism in a one-to-one relationship could deprive a wife to be able to give a ready hand, to give a ready aid her sympathy and charity would afford. She has, a side note, benevolence hindered, and therefore postulates the higher sense of marriage as the marriage of the union of hearts. Then the restrictions are lessened. In this, she also says here that then shall soul rejoice in its own, in which passion has no part. Then white-robed purity will unite in one person masculine wisdom and feminine love, spiritual understanding, the masculine mind, and perpetual peace, the feminine mind, will unite in one person. See, now we get to a spiritual sense of marriage. So here we must be quite clear that we must recognize that a human sense of marriage must not war against the higher sense of relationship, towards that sense of accomplishing the status of generic man, where everyone is wedded to every other one in heart and affection, and that that state must be the savior to a limited, narrow, selfish, jealous, mistrusting sense of the only sense of marriage, where just one person is related to the other and says, this is our center and circumference, and what happens outside our home is just of no interest to us and no responsibility to us. That would be wrong. The nature of man as God's idea, naturally, is wide and universal. And everything that wants to restrict that is a concession and is struggling against the spiritualization of man. And therefore, the higher sense of man here must bring a relationship which is a one to the universal relationship, one related to the universe. All the other narrow sense of a one-to-one relationship in the human leads, as she says, to personal domination and personal restriction and personal limitations. It leads to hindrance of benevolence, namely because it's all selfish and it's the inhumanity and the covetousness and the domestic tyranny which she brings out here. It's really against isolationism. It's a sense that men cannot be isolated, just as a nation cannot be isolated. But isolationism is struggling against truth as principle, because man's nature as principle is generic and therefore must be related to every other one. And any attempt to restrict that is struggling against the advancement of the spiritual idea. Then we come to the fifth subject of life, down on page 64, line 26, where she says, until it is learned that God is the Father of all, until, you see, we get again that until, marriage will continue. We had already that at the beginning of the chapter. But the main point is here, let not mortals permit a disregard of law which might lead to a worse state of society than now exists. Honesty and virtue ensure the stability of the marriage covenant. Spirit will ultimately claim its own, all that really is, and the voices of physical sense will be forever hushed. What he brings in here now as life is that man must recognize the higher nature of man by seeing that man of God's creating must support everything which is progressive. Spirit will claim its own, all that really is, but ultimately. But the chapter on marriage has nothing to do with that ultimate, it's the transitional stage, leading finally to the ultimate. So, truth as principle showed us the union of hearts, and truth as life secures against free love, really. It must, so that our understanding and devotion must be directed towards bringing forth something always better than now exists, something higher than now exists, to support the highest that now exists, to promote and secure that which is best under the present circumstances. It's always in the comparative. And then we come to truth as truth on the next page, where she shows that experience should be the school of virtue. That's really the whole touch of the chapter on marriage, that experience should be the school of virtue. Our whole life is a school of virtue. Our whole life, that temporal stage, is a school where we discipline, where we have a chance of learning to discipline ourselves in keeping prayer and atonement and Eucharist. If we discipline ourselves to devote ourselves to prayer, namely always to approach God more and more in the right way, in the divine way, and discipline ourselves every day and every week and every year more and more in atonement and Eucharist by ousting out of our thoughts and feeling and life and actions and so on, everything that is against this prayerful attitude, that is our experience, that school of virtue. That is marriage. That's the standpoint of marriage. In early edition, she wrote, marriage should be the school of virtue. And she broadened it out in the present edition by saying experience, because it's true, you see, all the we bachelors must go through the same training, exactly the same. We are not a bit out of it. And human happiness should proceed from man's highest nature. See, now she shows that this comparative state, that our transitional stage should always be the outcome of our understanding of man's highest nature. She shows here so clearly what we have seen last time, that this chapter is not an improvement out of the first degree through the second degree to the third degree, but that it is the exemplification of this improvement, but dictated by the third degree. It's man's highest nature that is always dictating the terms, because before marriage we had atonement and Eucharist, you see, which showed that very high standard, first in prayer as reaching out for the only and higher standard, namely what is God. And in atonement and Eucharist it reached out for that highest standard, which says, and that higher standard doesn't allow anything besides it. Thou shalt have only one God and no other God beside me. And so marriage always draws its strength and its substance from prayer and atonement and Eucharist. Marriage alone can't stand. It would just be a nice human exposition with lots of morality in it. But in its third stage, as that which always draws its substance and strength and its power and its inspiration from the chapter on prayer and the chapter on atonement and Eucharist, is always lining up everything in the human, in the temporal, in the transitional stage, lining up to that highest sense. And so is always inspired by the highest inspiration. Therefore she says, may Christ's truth be present at every bridal altar to turn the water, I nearly had a Texanian accent, to turn the water into wine and to give to human life an inspiration by which man's spiritual and eternal existence may be discerned. She shows here, let Christ's truth be present at every bridal altar to turn the water into the wine. For what? It's always to see man's spiritual and eternal existence, always to prove life. And never what sometimes we would like to see, that we see, well, let's get married because we like to get married, and let's have science as our servant, so that science can serve in our marriage. No, it's the other way around. Our marriage must serve science, because it's only the principle of science that must be worked out. And marriage can be, if properly handled, a very wonderful servant to reach this goal. It is that concession which she says is for the advancement of spiritual good. But its aim must be the highest, and not the other way around. Therefore it is to work out man's spiritual and eternal existence. And then, lastly, we have the climax of it, where we have to recognize that the more metaphysical our foundations become, that the more we attain true manhood. See, the whole sixth subject is a wedding ourselves to a more scientific understanding, a more metaphysical understanding of God and man. And here at the climax she points out that to gain Christian Zionism and its harmony, in order to gain more harmony, to gain a better humanhood, life should be more metaphysically regarded. Life should be more metaphysically regarded. So it gives a sense that really the aim of our life is to reach higher and higher in our understanding, to see clearer and clearer the purpose and meaning and content and of metaphysics. And that the higher we see that, the more that Christ is at the bridal altar and turns the water into wine, and turns our human outlook, our thinking, our measure of mentality into an inspired, more scientific, more exalted outlook of life. Well, that's what he says about the sixth subject.